This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
This is your current affairs program, The Rainbow Report, on Joy 94.9.
Good evening and welcome to The Rainbow Report. This week, regular host Doug Pollard is still sunning himself somewhere north of the border, and he's handed the reins once again to me, Cathy Anderson. I'm joined in the studio tonight by two of Melbourne's political heavyweights, maybe not so heavy in Hayley's case, Hayley Conway, co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, and Tim Wilson from the Institute of Public Affairs, who's also a co-host on The Spin on
and
Joy.
And I'm not that heavy, I might add.
Hey! Well, I mean in size, but certainly in terms of political spectrum, we've got both. So we've got one right on the left and one on the right. So am I right in consuming?
Right on the
assuming?
left on the right? Yeah, we've got it.
We're going to have covered. Some energising debate tonight.
Look forward to it.
We've got some pretty interesting stories on the show tonight for you. First up, we're going to hear a report from California, where the Supreme Court has upheld the ban against gay marriage. It's bad news also from the Apple Isle, with the verdict by the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Tribunal to uphold the current ban on blood donations to the Red Cross from gay men. Later on, we'll speak to Michael Caine, the man who has been fighting this case for 6 years. Community broadcasting appears to be living in struggle town this week as the government's budget has given it the cold shoulder, and there's an uphill battle to obtain a digital licence. We'll have Channel 31's digital campaigning coordinator Campbell Manderson in the studio with us tonight, which is great, and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia's Deb Welch also here to talk to us about what this means for the future of programs such as Bent TV and Joy. The National Consultation on Human Rights has been conducting its consultation forums across the country, and later we'll be joined by one of its committee members, well-known journalist and author Mary Kostakidis, who will update us on the project. And last but never least, she makes sure of it, we'll be joined by political satirist extraordinaire Kay Sarah. Welcome back to the Rainbow Report with me, Cathy Anderson, Hayley Conway and Tim Wilson. California's gay marriage laws have been up and down like a yo-yo. It was a historical victory when the law passed, and some considered a national tragedy when Proposition 8 overturned it. Now the final battle seems to have been lost as the Supreme Court has upheld the ban. We're going to a report now by Jennifer Macy from ABC World Today.
Thousands of protesters cried with outrage outside the Californian Supreme Court in San Francisco after the decision was made to uphold a ban on same-sex marriages in the state. Police arrested more than 100 protesters who blocked a busy intersection.
The movement for intolerance in this state is powerful, and we have a long battle ahead of us.
We were extremely disappointed. The court has tarnished its legacy as a defender of equality by allowing this discriminatory measure to stand in our state's constitution.
We just wish we lived in a world where we could all have the same rights.
Radio. That was the report from Jennifer Macy. There is a silver lining to this very dark cloud, however, and we'll hear now from City Attorney of California, Dennis Herrera.
Today we're faced with a disappointing decision, but I think we also know it could have been worse. Yes, we're disappointed that Proposition 8 was upheld, but we're also grateful that Prop 8's advocates did not succeed in their cruel effort to unmarry 18,000 lawfully wed couples.
Right, guys, so we've got a ban that's been upheld. People can't get married anymore in the state of California, but the 18,000 couples who did walk down the aisle can still be called legally married. What do you think?
Well, look, I think this is a really interesting situation where you're looking at creating not only first and second class sort of status relationships between heterosexual and opposite sex couples, but also then these people who managed to get married early and are considered to be same-sex married couples and same-sex couples who now aren't allowed to get married and heteros who can get married. And also, you know, we need to remember that in the US you can't actually be recognised as a de facto couple. You're either married or you don't have any rights as a couple at all. So, look, it's really disgraceful that this has been held up, and it certainly is, you know, a real sort of slap in the face, I think, for the community.
I think it shows, actually, just how much of a sham the whole debate has become and how much a hodgepodge of outcomes. I mean, one of the things, the big differences between Australia and the United States is the very strong emphasis on state rights and the rights of the state governments to legislate what is defined by a marriage versus us, which is a federal government. And when you have almost all of New England now that has endorsed same-sex marriage, either through courts or through legislation, and then you have a state like California, which has now got this bizarre recognition of existing marriages, but not the ones that were endorsed by Gary Newsom in San Francisco, but the ones that were temporarily introduced through, when there was at the start of last year. Mm-hmm. It shows how much has become a sham. While I have a lot of sympathy for gay rights activists and people who feel that their relationships should be recognised, including under marriage in California, the simple reality is that these Californians need to convince the general population to overturn Prop 8. And I actually think that's quite possible, because the circumstances in which Prop 8 passed were quite unique. They were almost entirely dependent on a large chunk of the black community in southern parts of California coming out to vote at the last presidential election, mm-hmm. primarily to vote for Barack Obama, but also to vote against gay marriage in the same process. And I actually think it can be overturned, and I think they will overturn it.
So what's the? It does seem to be a bit of a dichotomy. I mean, you will have 18,000 couples now. I mean, how legally do we know how that will affect their legal rights in terms of all sorts of things, of benefits and recognition, as opposed to same-sex couples who can't live in de facto versus heterosexual couples who are legally married?
Well, as I was saying before, in the United States, there is no de facto status for couples. So regardless of how intertwined your life and finances are, unless you're married, the state, the government, doesn't perceive you in that way, and therefore you don't receive any of the benefits that married couples do. So presumably then these same-sex couples who will continue to have their marriages recognised will be treated as such by various taxation bodies and in terms of health schemes and all of those sorts of things. But certainly those who can't get married won't have those benefits.
It will also depend on what state they seek to have their relationship recognised. Right. In California, they'll of course have the full entitlements of marriage. If they go to Texas, it will change. If they go to what's one of the states? New Jersey hasn't. New Hampshire, I think, has done it recently. Mm. So it will depend on that in large part. So it's going to be a really sort of dynamic atmosphere. But all it's really going to do is keep the issue alive, and it's going to keep moving on both sides.
It seems interesting that this has happened, considering, as you said, there are other states who are coming on board. It seems to have been gathering momentum, particularly issues of social justice and social change, which have been at the forefront since the Obama campaign. I think there's probably a lot of positive ideas that, you know, he would bring some sort of social change. What kind of message is it sending, do you reckon, that's, you know, one state is doing this and the other is doing that? Is that a surprise? Or
can I just add, I forgot to say one thing in the previous comment before I answer that question, which is in California, they actually have a lot of entitlements for people who can already nominate their beneficiary for superannuation laws and whatnot.
Right,
so
okay.
For a lot of people, regardless whether they're married or not, it won't make a huge change in their life. It's much more symbolic. But to answer your question, no, this isn't a surprise, because Obama rode on a wave of people disenchanted. You know, there's no ambiguity with the Bush administration, with the Republicans in Congress, and to a certain extent with the Democrats in Congress as well, hoping for a generational change, but a philosophical change to government. One of the things that has become abundantly clear since he has been elected is that he has been a very much a business-as-usual president, gone straight for the centrist ground where he can to try and garner maximum political support so that he is up for, because he's only up for election, 2 years' time or two and a half years' time, essentially, after he gets to the primary process. So this isn't a radical surprise. And, you know, America is culturally and politically a right of centre country, or a conservative country. So is this a surprise? Absolutely not, because one of the things Obama did during his campaign is try not to deal with a lot of these problems, to try and get around them.
Yep. What's going to happen from here on in with other states? Do you think there is going to be a shift back to, now that California's held this up, is there going to be a shift for any of that momentum that may have been building because other states are going towards gay marriage to sort of pull the reins back?
Well, I certainly think this is going to energise both sides of this debate. in every state, and what you'll see is probably states where maybe they might have a more sort of traditionally left leaning voting population and that sort of thing, maybe then they'll find that their states actually respond more positively because, you know, in response to what's happened in California, whereas more, you know, right states might look to, I guess, you know, strengthen their laws against things or something. But you'll certainly see a push, I think, from both sides, and it will be energising for everyone.
I agree with that. And one of the most exciting things, the things I love about America the most, is the fact that people aren't spending their time always agreeing. And what the United States is doing is having a really fierce debate, you know, and some of it brings out the best and the worst in people. And I say that on both sides, I have to say, because some of the language used by people on the pro-gay marriage side is just as hate-filled as stuff from people who are anti. But it is a very dynamic debate. It is, you know, what is going to happen depending on which state. We basically have New England now that has almost entirely recognition of same-sex couples. And then you have those sort of Midwestern states, which at this point aren't going to go near it. But it is going to be pushed onto the agenda. And in so many ways, that is exciting, just because you will get to see the debate and to see how people grapple with it, and also how different states deal with it, because they're not going to, and they haven't to date, dealt with it uniformly. There still hasn't really been many legislators who've got the guts to actually introduce laws recognising gay marriage.
Well, it's certainly going to be an interesting process to see what happens in the US, and of course, because Australia often follows the US lead, we'll take a very keen interest in how it goes here. We're going to have a quick break, and we're back to speak with Michael Caine about the blood ban update. You're listening to the Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
Keeping the GLBTI community up to date, this is the Rainbow Report.
Welcome back to the Rainbow Report with me, Kathy Anderson, Hayley Conway and Tim Wilson. Tasmanian gay man Michael Caine was banned from donating his blood to the Red Cross because the Red Cross deems gay men ineligible. He took his case to the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Tribunal, and he's on the line now to discuss the verdict. Good evening.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. And tell us, you've obviously been involved in this process for a long time. We've spoken to you about this on the Rainbow Report before. I believe the decision's been handed down.
It has, that's right. I started this when I was 21, so it's 6 years ago this year, so it's been quite a large part of my life, especially my adult life.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I know, that's what I was thinking. but yeah, no, the decision was handed down yesterday by the tribunal members, and while they fundamentally agree with a lot of the issues that I raised, they've had to side with the Red Cross in this situation. They've erred on the side of caution, but just because the epidemiological data just isn't quite there at the moment, so that'll be our next step in the process. I mean, the court case is over. The campaign most certainly is not. We'll continue to fight for gay men rights to donate blood.
So basically the Red Cross is saying that they deem the blood from gay men is ineligible because you've had male-to-male contact and there's a higher risk of you transmitting a sexual disease. Is that pretty much on the money?
That's predominantly right, yeah. HIV, I think, is their primary concern when it comes to gay men. There's certain cohorts around that have different burdens of disease, and unfortunately ours happens to be HIV, but that's what they're saying. But one of the fantastic things that came down in the tribunal decision was they actually said, which I don't think has been done before, that it's just an assumed thing that gay men aren't all promiscuous. They actually said in their decision, which was fantastic, that not all people of the gay cohort are the same. We have varying degrees of promiscuity, which is exactly the same for the heterosexual community. I mean, and it's great that that's actually been mentioned, because beforehand it was sort of giving the impression that stigmatising that all gay men were promiscuous and at risk of disease, and heterosexuals weren't, which is stigmatising to us, obviously, and that a dangerous message to young heterosexuals. So I'm kind of glad that they've actually done that now, and we can move on.
Well, it seems incomprehensible that they hadn't known that before, really, but there you go. So from here on in, are they going to look at readjusting the policy? Are they recommending to the Red Cross that they should do something different with their criteria?
No, the tribunal pretty much has decided that the current policy is suitable for what's going on at the moment. What we plan to do about that is find the data that's required. As soon as we get that data, we'll be back before the tribunal fast so that you can say, take my blood. And we're also going to consider approaching the Red Cross and actually asking them to do their own independent trial, take gay blood for a period of time, test it, study it, and get their results so they can stop hypothesizing about how dangerous we are and actually find out, in a matter of fact, how dangerous we aren't.
Michael, Tim Wilson here. Just a quick question. What has been the attitude to the Red Cross throughout this process? Because it sounds like they're taking a very risk management or risk aversion approach. Have they actually been engaging in dialogue and interested in finding out what the facts are, or are they just sticking to a very stringent line?
Unfortunately, no, they haven't engaged in much dialogue at all. The day after I went to donate in October 2004, I wrote a letter the very next day to the regional manager, which I'm still waiting for a reply from, and just the entire time it's been a complete process of corporation risk analysis. And it's really frustrating that this has happened. I was kind of naive when I started this process. I kind of expected them to go to the point where the commission referred it to a tribunal, which was a world's first that the Red Cross has ever been forced to justify its actions in front of a law committee, that they would actually go, well, this guy's serious, let's sit down and talk about where we can go from here. But the whole thing was pretty much straight and narrow. We're going to defend this quite heavily, and that's what they did.
Well, Michael, it sounds as though you've had six long years of this case, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more where we can keep us updated on that issue, and all the very best.
Thank you very much. I'm kind of worried that I'll be past their age eligibility before my letter. we'll definitely try and get it before then.
Well, you're doing good work for future generations. Thanks very much for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
Informing, entertaining and provoking. This is The Rainbow Report.
Welcome back to The Rainbow Report with me, Kathy Anderson, Hayley Conway and Tim Wilson. In Australia, community TV and radio has played an important role in producing local and diverse programs and content. It's an important social medium, often free from restrictions that govern commercial broadcasting, and it's the breeding ground of grassroots creativity and often political discussion, just like the program you're listening to now on Joy. So what will happen with community TV and radio as our analog signals fade and we all convert to digital TVs? Joining us in the studio is Campbell Manderson, the digital campaign coordinator at Channel 31 in Melbourne, to tell us where community TV stands following the latest federal budget announcements. Good evening to you.
It's very good to be here.
We do love community broadcasting. So give us a bit of a rundown on where we're at with the digital issue and what your job is, because you are a full-time campaigner, as I understand it.
Yeah, pretty much. Been employed by 31 since just before the budget, but I was also a director of the company for the last 9 years. So mm-hmm. I've actually seen the place grow from the 1999 Save Our Arsathon, as I call it.
Love it.
I've seen the company grow into a fantastic organisation which has 28 full-member groups and 14 affiliates. Mm-hmm. We're in the black, and I mean, when digital set-top boxes started coming in about 3 years ago when I was on the board, we started to see a tapering of our ratings going off, and we were thinking, well, this is probably, you know, set-top boxes and the mm-hmm. introduction, so we figured that we had to do something about it, and so we invested over $360,000 in over 2 years in upgrading our transmitter so that we could get a greater penetration and reach in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told by the Senator Conroy that he had a great master plan, and it would be all announced in the budget. And when we got there, we found out there was nothing.
So, what did he actually promise to you? What were you expecting?
Well, what we need is carriage of community television until analog switch off. And what needs to be recognised is that this whole digital thing is an imposition on community TV. When it started out in the 80s or even the 70s, digital was not even heard of.
Mm.
The whole basis of what we were doing was all based around analog TV. So if not for digital, we probably would have been the most successful community television in the station, if not the world.
Right.
But because of digital, we've had this impact. And there was also the introduction of Foxtel, probably hasn't helped things.
Mm.
So over the last 3 years, we've actually brought our audience figures back to where they used to be.
Right.
But when the budget came out, there was nothing there.
What were you expecting?
Well, we were expecting that the government was going to maybe put together some sort of system which would transmit a digital signal in the cities,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty much come to nothing. And on Senate estimates hearings the other night, Senator Ludlam from the Greens managed to extract from Senator Conroy that there wouldn't be any funding for the transition of community TV till next year.
Right.
And in Melbourne, we can't sit on our hands for that long.
So when does digital TV take over? When does analog expire? What sort of timeline do we have?
It's going to be a rolling thing, and they're going to be rolling it out through regional Australia first, and they're going to be leaving the mainland cities last.
Mm.
So it's between June and December in 2013. And you might think, well, that's a long way off. But when you look at the measures in the budget, it's almost like a predatory practice. We've got $140 million... being allocated, and that's going to go to our competitors to run ads to get people to buy digital.
By competitors, do you mean commercial media?
Well, the commercial stations are the one that are most likely going to reap all of this money, $140 million.
That doesn't compute. Well, I don't understand.
I know. Well, I mean, the thing is, if they had actually come forward, Senator Conroy stated that that their estimates were $2 million in each capital city would facilitate migration of community TV. Now, if you look at community TV in Australia, in every state, every station is different. We share content, but it's local content.
Mm-hmm.
And the government's announced millions upon millions of dollars for more local content by ABC and SBS. We're giving it to the community for free.
You said that it was going to be a transition from analog to digital in 2013, but that the government may be allocating funding next year in the budget. So won't that be in time?
We don't want to wait, to be quite honest. You know, we've already gone through seeing that lapse. I don't think that we can turn, we can invest more money into our transmitter to increase our signal. So at the moment, what we would prefer is just to get the allocation of Channel 38. In Melbourne, there are three channels that aren't being used. They're gathering dust. So, I mean,
are digital channels?
Well, it's called Spectrum, mm-hmm. and it could be used for digital or analog.
Right.
So at the moment, there are three channels that are just gathering dust, doing nothing, and we could be using those
mm-hmm.
to broadcast.
And who owns the licence to those three?
Well, they're unlicensed at the moment. They're not allocated for any use.
They're owned by the government.
Yeah.
Right, I see.
And it's another thing that I need to point out is the governments do not own the airways. They are there to manage them on the best interests of the Australian people.
Mm.
And I don't think the Australian people are being best served by the current government.
So are you having ongoing discussions with the government about these licences or funding? Are you having some sort of dialogue with them?
Well, look, in the lead-up to the election, yes, we'd had many conversations, but we're now at a point where it's sort of like they just keep on trotting out the same line. In March this year, Senator Conroy said at the Digital Convergent Conference that community TV would not be left behind. Now, when Senator Alston introduced digital in 98, which is 11 years ago, he said that community television would not be left behind. So we're hearing the same thing from successive governments over 11 years. We've really had enough. And I think we're at a stage where we have to say to them, look, you guys might not be competent at this stuff, but we are.
Well, what's it going to take? What sort of money do you need in order to, you know, to get a digital spectrum or to have a channel that's like allocated for you and in order for it to run?
Senator Conroy's estimates were $2 million. Now, that's okay. In five states, that would be $10
million.
Mm. And that's for a new transmitter, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And the maintenance and the upgrade, because we have to pay site fees, we have to pay power. So he said $2 million. I sort of like think we could do it for potentially 1.5. Now, we've got 1.5 million viewers.
Mm.
Now, for $1... we could essentially do it ourselves. We, the community, could do this ourselves. And I really need to state that community television has never been federally funded from its time and of existence, from Open Channel through to the test broadcasts in the late 80s around suburbs of Melbourne to the formation of the Melbourne Community Television Consortium. We've never received funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, through all of this, We have developed new playout systems so that we can broadcast 24/7. We've implemented training that we've shared with other states.
Yep.
We're pretty much in the black with a brand new spanking transmitter. And we've got a permanent license. So, you know, I think the government's, successive governments have been incompetent in this regard, and I think it's time for us to take it up.
You have to say, I question whether government should really be involved with community radio or community television or radio for that matter. But I think when they change the regulatory environment and tell people they have to switch off one transmitter, which they rightfully bought legally, which actually provided a service, and then tell them they have to switch to something else, there is an obligation on government when they change that regulatory environment to fund the structural adjustment to the new the new system. And so I don't see why the government would want to perpetuate, not facilitating. Although, as I said before, it sounds like you don't want to wait. It's not so much that you won't have the option. It's just that you're concerned that in between the period in which analog goes off to digital, that there's a period where people are switching over and that you're hopeful that there'll be funding next year.
Well, as I say, we don't want to wait. We don't want to wait on potentially another broken promise.
Well, it seems like we've also joined in the studio with the discussion by Deb Welch. She's the president of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Hi there, Deb.
Thanks very much for having me too.
No problem. Look, you probably can shed some light on this debate because, of course, community broadcasting does cover radio as well. Are you in a similar situation?
Well, radio, CBAA represents radio and TV stations, but vastly more radio stations. You know, there's over 300. And in the radio environment, there's no plans yet to turn off analog. Mm. So digital radio is on its way in now without any date, like TV has, where there's a turn off. So the pressure is less in that sense. But in fact, the government has funded the transition, or the first part of the transition for radio, to move to digital. So that does seem rather ironic. I can imagine if you're in the community TV area. But it's only for a limited number of stations. It's at a lesser community radio stations don't get the same deal that commercial radio stations get, or the ABC or SBS. So we won't be competing on equal terms. And I think one of the issues that you were raising that's really sitting underneath this whole discussion, I think, I was really thinking this when Cam was talking, is what sort of broadcasting environment we want in Australia. In a way, we're a spectacularly lucky country in that we've got the best community broadcasting sector in the world. We always have had, particularly in areas in the area of radio, bigger, developed faster and earlier than most other places in the world, and became quite a powerful force, so much so that Australian people just think it's normal to have community radio. And in other countries, it's not at all normal. So many just have commercial. Many just have a government radio service that's government controlled, and many countries still think, oh my god, you couldn't possibly let ordinary people on the radio, what might they say? You know,
so a lot of people think that about Joy, but I mean, we're very lucky here at Joy that we do have a very big community base. And interesting that Tim said before about funding. I mean, what do you think about the whole idea of whether or not government should be giving community and commercial the same amount of money or none at all?
I think people would be of the belief that they don't give any money to commercial radio, and they would be absolutely wrong. Commercial radio gets an enormous slab of government money through government advertising campaigns. In the community broadcasting sector, we've tried for years to get an equal share of that. But advertising agencies just have a quick sort of slip it through the commercial stations. So you don't remember all those huge Howard government era advertising yes, budgets? Definitely. Well, that went to commercial media.
Right. Funnily enough, I think we're going to get those in the next few months as
well. We might find they go largely to commercial media, and that would be 100 times the funding that's ever gone to the community broadcasting sector. Beyond that, a lot of the commercial sector has received funding, for example, to fill in black spots in regional areas where transmission didn't go, or to do all sorts of things that they just wouldn't do if it was left to the market. And I think if you want to have a diverse media in any country, you don't just leave it to what, you know, battle of the fittest, whatever you want to call it. If you want to have community-based services running largely by volunteers, then some infrastructure has to be in place so that those volunteers don't spend 90% of their time trying to find the money to run the service. They do spend 90% of their time doing it.
Yep.
And every community media organisation in the country has this battle. And, you know, the community TV people, you can see this is the ongoing one battle they've had for years. We would all rather... Nobody needs to live in luxury in the community broadcasting environment, but we would rather focus on the product, the content, mm-hmm. the things we're talking to you listeners about.
Without having to stress about where the money comes from.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, the government, whichever government it was, has given some things to the community broadcasting sector. They have voluntarily given up Spectrum, which is actually a very valuable commodity, which could have been sold off to the private sector, which could have been used for general income revenue purposes. Yeah. And so there actually has been a very significant infrastructure that makes the service that is being provided by the community sector absolutely vital. I mean, personally, I actually think it's great that the government isn't involved in community broadcasting by and large, because whenever there is a government dollar, there is a string attached to it, and I oppose that every step of the way. But again, you come back to that point, when we're going from the switch to analog to digital, when the government's basically making your property worthless, you have an absolute entitlement to turn around and say, well, where's my investment?
And look, the spectrum is valuable, but I wouldn't say gave it away. You know, I would say dedicated...
With strings attached.
Not even that much, many strings attached, but they dedicated it to a useful purpose for the community, which is what they're there to govern for. You know, they're not there to make enormous profits. They're there to do the best things with whatever resources are available to the country. And I think, you know, the 25,000 people involved in community radio, the TV figures, but, you know, 9.5 million people around the country listen. There's absolutely no doubt people in Australia value that use of the spectrum, but it's like being given a great car and never having any maintenance, petrol, anything to drive it with, and therefore you can end up looking like you're not succeeding in using it well because you've sort of been set up to fail. And community radio funding has decreased in real terms by an enormous amount over the last period of time because the number of stations that have come in has grown, like Joy's one of them, in recent years, and the pie stayed basically the same.
How do you feel, actually, the future of community radio? Because, of course, yes, funding may have decreased, but, of course, the technology to produce community radio has actually decreased as well, and commercial radio.
The cost of
producing in terms of technology that may be required.
No, I disagree with you there.
Well, depending on what technology we're talking about. But what I'm really principally asking is about internet radio as the future of radio as a broadcasting mechanism. How do you see community radio and internet radio?
I think they're just two different, internet radio can be commercial, can be government run, can be community, it can be any of those things. The beautiful, wonderful, great value of radio, and I can say that virtually every single person listening to us right now is not looking at the radio. Or you can look right now. But they're not looking. Mm. And they're not tied. They're not stuck somewhere. They're maybe walking around the kitchen. Some of you in the car going somewhere, whatever. That's one of the great qualities of radio is that you can do something else. And it's why, to me, radio has survived every technological challenge that's been thrown at it for the last 60, 70 years and will continue to... The internet's an interesting way of delivering it because a lot of people spend a lot of time sitting at their computer, but it doesn't actually make up for the free access through the airwaves, no cost to anybody, turn it on, that radio provides. And that just because that's a long-standing technology, it doesn't mean it's not a great technology.
Mm-hmm. Cam, did you want to say something?
Yeah, look, I would make the point, because we've sort of... it has been mentioned in TV too. It's like, oh, why don't you guys just do stuff on YouTube? And the whole idea of community broadcasting is that it is accessible on commonly available equipment. I.e., you know, there's a hard rubbish collection, you find a TV that works, you go home, stick a coat hanger in it, bang, you can get it.
Channel 31.
That's the whole point. And the thing with internet and broadband is there is a monthly cost attached to it.
Yeah.
And that is basically the principles that community radio and TV have been developed on.
Yeah, and I really support it because you don't want to turn something free into user pays sort of almost by stealth.
Yeah.
You really want to understand that, and that's why I think it's still a very viable, valid medium, and it probably will happen on that end. Mm. On the internet.
Well, it's interesting, you were talking before, Deb, about people, you know, appreciating the diversity of community radio and the people and the volunteers that get involved. And I'm sure there are a lot of our listeners out there who obviously love Joy, tune in to Bent TV on Channel 31. If people want to get involved and want to help in this regard, how are they able to do so?
Oh, look, I think the most significant thing you can do is become a subscriber of your station or a number of stations.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you have a radiothon. Or
yes, we do. It's coming up in June, actually.
And that wasn't a plant that I just did. But, you know, most community stations do.
Yep.
And if you subscribe to a station, it doesn't cost you much money.
Yep.
But it means you've put your hand up as a supporter. And if your station's in threat at some time, you're one of the people that they can call on. Either just, you know, could you send mm-hmm. a letter? Could you make a phone call? Could you do those things? And that's the power of community media, that people really
Certainly.
Support it.
And that's something that we often do with Joy and get people to become a member. So everyone listening should now become a member of Joy and tune in to Bent TV. Thank you so much for both coming into the studio. We've got to wrap it up there, but it's great to talk to you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, you're listening to The Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Informing, entertaining and provoking. This is The Rainbow Report.
Welcome back to The Rainbow Report with me, Kathy Anderson, Hayley Conway and Tim Wilson. Human rights is a hot potato at the moment, with the National Consultation on Human Rights has been conducting its consultation forums where members of the public are being asked what they see as important rights to be enshrined in Australia. We'll be speaking in just a moment to Mary Kostakidis about the feedback. She's a committee member, journalist and news presenter, but Hayley Conway is in the studio. She's going to give us a little bit of background first, very briefly.
Obviously, this consultation is going on around the country at the moment, and certainly the federal government has sent their crack team of human rights consultationists to various states and cities around the place just to have conversations with the community, basically, which is great. And also, the Also Foundation and the lobby have just finished drafting, or their first draft, of our submission to the consultation. So certainly that's something that we'll be looking for some feedback on within our various accountability structures.
Okay, well, Mary's on the line now to tell us about the public forums. Good evening, Mary.
Hi, Kathy. Hello, everyone, and good to hear you're working on a submission. Just make sure you get it in by June the 15th, because that's the cut-off date.
Oh, we're all over it.
With all the deadlines. Now, you've been going around the country hearing people's opinions on human rights. What have you discovered?
Well, we're very pleased at the level of interest in talking about human rights, and often people in the beginning can't quite conceive of what they are or how they really relate to daily life. You know, people often think of human rights belonging to people that are in extraordinary circumstances somewhere else in the world. That the people who live in societies that aren't healthy democracies like ours. And it's only when we start to talk about the nature of human rights and talk about how they apply to daily life, to us as individuals and as members of a majority even, and certainly as members potentially at any time in our lives of a minority. And one of the things that's coming up a lot is the key issue, which is, are the most vulnerable in society adequately protected? Are their rights adequately protected?
And are you being specific? I mean, because you're conducting city and rural consultations, are you getting different minorities concerns in those areas?
Right. Look, the concerns are much the same across the board. They are both civil and political rights that people are concerned about, but even more so, the social and economic rights, and even more so, social and economic rights in country areas. So in rural areas where services aren't as good as they are in the cities, it's to be expected that people will be more concerned about those particular rights. So the issues that come up most are homelessness, the rights of people with mental illness, the rights of our Indigenous community, and the rights of groups that have been marginalised and discriminated against in the past or continue to be discriminated against, for example, the gay community.
Mary, Tim Wilson speaking. Just a quick query. Has there been any discussion about property rights as part of human rights? Because, you know, in countries like Australia or the Western political tradition, property rights is considered a very important part of human rights. Has that come up at all?
A little, but I'd be very keen to know what you have to say about it.
No, well, I'm a big fan, but I'm not sure. I mean, we already have a protection of property rights. I'm not sure adding it into a charter would necessarily achieve anything. But I think one of the most bizarre things about this sort of discussion today is, well, it's understandable that a lot of the issues that are coming up are those of people who feel marginalised, but there really are a number of rights that, you know, I would equate equally, with whether it be property rights, whether it be social and political and rights as well. And I think, you know, it should be in the mix, because I don't think it's something that can just be easily dismissed. Should the government, for instance, be able to come and take your property and then you not be compensated for it? You know, isn't that a right?
Well, absolutely. And is that the situation where the government can take your property and you aren't compensated for it?
Well, the Commonwealth Constitution actually says you must be compensated for it, but the state of Victoria doesn't.
Well, you see, this consultation is occurring on behalf of the federal government, so we have to address the federal jurisdiction. And so, you know, if you're talking about state issues, they don't really fall in our domain, I'm afraid.
It sounds as though, Mary, with this process, from what you've said, there are a lot of people talking more about social issues, even though you said there are economic issues, and protecting the rights of people who may not be able to help themselves.
That's right, yes, the rights of people who are voiceless. But, you know, as I said earlier, the more you talk about human rights, the more people realise that actually they do loom large in their own lives. So, for example, when we grow old, we do want to be treated with dignity, or if we're on unemployment benefits, we still want to be treated with dignity by the bureaucracy. And if we live in a housing commission property, we want to ensure that our rights are protected. So there's a lot of recognition about the central role of human rights in daily life.
Now, with this consultation, you're basically going to create, or the idea is to create, a charter, not a law. Is that correct, or am I off the money there?
No, look, that's one of the options, and that's a very controversial topic. But really, we're interested in where the problems are, so that if people can say, well, this is my major concern, I think the way we're going about this is terrible, and this is what I think is needed to fix it. This is what I think would be a fairer way to go about things. So the government wants to know if we're falling short of our protection of human rights, and if that's the case, where that is, and then what options there are that might address the situation and improve things. So there are many ways in which one could improve the situation. For example, should we beef up scrutiny of proposed bills by Parliament? Should policies and bureaucracy, you know, the policies that bureaucracies have be scrutinised for their human rights implications, not just policies but practices in bureaucracies. And,
sorry, I just wanted to interrupt there, because I think you made a really interesting point, which is, you know, people often think about human rights in terms of how people can treat one another, myself and the person sitting next to me, what can they do to me? But also it's about that person's relationship very much to the state. Has that come out up a lot about how the government has to treat people and what the basic standards are?
Yes, and in fact, if the government were to look at a charter, to just answer the previous question, it wouldn't be a charter that's entrenched in the Constitution like the American Bill of Rights. It would be a piece of legislation, and it would really apply to the relationship between government and citizens.
So, Mary, I'm sorry to cut you off. We are skimming out of time here, but you mentioned a June 15 deadline for submissions, and O'Haley's working furiously on the gay and lesbian rights lobby submissions. How can people still get involved in this process, and where can they get more information?
Okay, the website is www.humanrightsconsultation.gov.au, and you can share your views by clicking on the website and just filling in a form there.
Brilliant. Well, I encourage all of our listeners to do so, and thank you very much for your time tonight. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
That was Mary Costakidis there. We're on the Rainbow Report, and we're skipping straight ahead to Kay Sarah, our favourite political satirist. She's throwing her sequined 2 cents into the other top news story this week, the change to next year's Sydney Mardi Gras party.
First, Midsummer shuffled the chairs on the deck. Now it's Mardi Gras' turn. News of the week is the reformatting of Sydney's Mardi Gras, separating the famous parade and the big party, and shortening the whole celebration to boot. Tempers are running hot. We march in the parade to the party. That's how it's always been. The euphoria of the parade fuels the fling at the showground afterwards. The Mardi Gras committee beg to differ. People are too tired from the parade to party all night long, they argue. And as for the shorter festival time frame, well, that's to focus activities into a tighter unit. It's the quality over quantity argument. Sounds to me like the bean counters are winning the day. Bless their diamante-studded calculators. Welcome to the real world. Our midsummer has already bitten the golden bullet. Spiralling costs associated with an opening night party, midsummer have opted out. To get around the revenue shortfall, they've shuffled the traditional closing carnival day to the front of the festival, launching the whole shebang. It was an awkward move that left some of us baffled, particularly as the festival now has no closing event. As any show queen will tell you, it ain't where you start, it's where you finish. Thankfully, common sense has prevailed, and next year's midsummer will open with the carnival day and feature the Pride March as the closing celebration. Of course, our festivals are not alone in feeling the squeeze of the pink dollar. In Sydney, the demise of Oxford Street is robustly documented, and here in Melbourne, the promise of a golden gay mile, namely Commercial Road, has never really eventuated. The closest this precinct came to fulfilling the mythical gay neighbourhood status was way back with Midsummer's opening street party. Remember, they closed up the whole street and installed rides and a couple of stages and the obligatory drinking pens. Okay, it was hard work. At the end of the day, Commercial Road will only ever be a windswept highway, but the festival spirit did bring with it a buzz. The Exchange busted out of its shell and shifted the drag shows up onto the rooftop. Hilarious. The Market hoisted the rainbow flag high and flooded out onto the street. Gay and straight businesses alike cashed in. Cries of dissent were drowned in the euphoria that maybe we had finally arrived. We've stopped the trams, for God's sake. That's got to mean something. Sadly, it didn't mean a thing, especially when the bill for stopping the trams arrived. Now we've moved on. We don't need street parties anymore, and we don't aspire to take over a whole neighbourhood either. That belonged to the ghetto days of the 70s and the heady 80s. The homo energy has filtered out, mixing it up on the camp end of Smith Street and a dozen other inner urban cafe latte belts, shaking its thing along with Generation Y and X and all the educated hangers-on. Speaking of which, I take it all back. Generation Y, or as I like to call them, look at my new iPhone. Well, they're fabulous after all. A heart-to-heart with a couple of young bunnies recently has convinced me they are not all spoiled, self-obsessed space cadets. They're just misguided. I'm Kay Sara, but really, only when you get me on a good day.
What will be, Kay Sara.
Party, party, party. Thanks, Kay. Well, it's been an action-packed show tonight, crammed everything in that we possibly could. My guests tonight were Michael Caine, Channel 31's Campbell Manderson, Deb Welch from the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, Mary Kostakidis, panellist Hayley Conway from the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, Tim Wilson from the Institute of Public Affairs, and, of course, Kay Sara. This show is produced with panache by Bianca Johnston and seamless technical production by Michael Bayliss. Thanks so much for your company tonight. We hope you've enjoyed the show. I'm Cathy Anderson, and the big man, Doug Pollard, will be back next week with another edition of the Rainbow Report.
This has been a Joy 94.9 news and current affairs presentation.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.